Welcome to the Cashflow Project Podcast. Are you looking to better your financial situation by increasing your cash flow? Too busy to hunt for real estate deals or don't know where to start? Then you're in the right spot. Join us as we dive in and talk about investing for cash flow using multifamily real estate.
Welcome to the Cashflow Project. I'm your host, Duke Ong with Tri-City Equity Group. With me is my co-host, Vince Gepp. Today we have Neil Bawa on the show. Neil is a technologist who is known as the mad scientist of multifamily. Besides being one of the most in-demand speakers in commercial real estate, Neil is a data guru, a process freak, and an outsourcing expert. Neil owns and manages a $320 million plus real estate multifamily portfolio, over 2,300 apartment units in 9 U.S. states. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Duke. Thank you, Vincent. I'm really thrilled to be on the show.
Outstanding. So I'll jump right into it. So a lot of our listeners do know about you. You're everywhere. You do tons of conferences, tons of events. But for those of us, or those of our listeners who don't know, maybe a little bit of background, what you do, and then talk about how you got started in investing.
Sure. So I am a geek, a dork, and a nerd. Those are things that I'm happy to be referred to as. My friends call me the mad scientist of multifamily because I'm constantly experimenting, I'm constantly changing things, constantly coming out with opinions that are often regarded as outrageous or just plain wrong. Doesn't really bother me. If you don't put out a lot of opinions, you're not going to know when you are wrong and when you are right. Our multifamily, we started off as multifamily syndicators. We currently have $345 million in assets, which are divided between multifamily, student housing, industrial, and self-storage. Two-thirds of our portfolio are new construction. One-third of our portfolio is value-add, and we prefer to keep it that way because one of our newest comments, and this is going to get me in trouble with both of you guys immediately, is that we believe that value-add is now an oxymoron. So in 2020, we're now getting to the point where people are selling anything and everything as value-add. This is a building that has been rehabbed 3 different times. It's a value-add because it can be rehabbed a 4th time. Here's a building with 200 units, with 50 units that are not rehabbed. That's a value-add. Anything and everything is selling as a value-add. Anything and everything is selling as a 4 cap. I mean, when's the last time anybody bought property at 6 cap? So we're buying older and older properties at lower and lower cap rates, and we're still calling them value-add, and we're still behaving as if nothing has changed. The market's behavior represents the behavior of brokers in 2006, and we all know how that ended. So maybe we can talk about that and the consequences of these kinds of actions as more and more people start believing their own BS to the point that BS becomes reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see it as well in a lot of our markets where they used to talk about that cap rate compression and like the risk is going up, but the returns are going low. That risk adjusted return is getting lower. So I can see a lot of the people that can do it, make the jump, doing that flight to safety, that flight to quality. Like if we're going to spend this much, we might as well just go that little extra little bit and get a nicer class asset where we have that core plus stuff. So that is awesome. So we, for those of us that don't know on the thing, so you started like everyone else, right? You started with a duplex and scaled up, or did you do something different?
In my case, it was very different. Most people start with a rental or they start with a flip. In my case, I started my career in real estate by building a campus from scratch. This was a $6 million campus in 2003. I was running a technology company and the CEO asked for my help in building the campus. He was the more experienced guy, and so I had to do everything under his guidance. But we built the campus while we ran this technology business with hundreds of employees. And it at the end of the process, which I didn't like, I whined and bitched and moaned and complained my way through the entire process saying, this is not my job. At the end of that, I realized that real estate is unique, not just in terms of cash flow or appreciation. It's unique in terms of how much it impacts any business. So my learning was completely different. I was thinking about real estate being a 10x multiplier for a business, which had nothing to do with real estate. It was a technology business. And that learning made me realize, okay, I need to learn more about real estate because this stuff is definitely different from anything else. It's a force multiplier for people. And I said, can I use this as a force multiplier to build my own wealth, to build my own long-term generational wealth that I can leave to my children? And that's what started my real estate journey in in about 2007 or 2008 when the recession was starting. Prior to that, I had already built a number of campuses for my company and I invested with them and I got the depreciation benefits. I had the big fat tech salary. So the fact that I was getting depreciation benefits was so awesome. I mean, there was this learning, which is not typical. You don't hear about it on podcasts, but it's incredibly beneficial. And so then I went backwards, I guess, and started in with single family in 2008 and built up a rather large portfolio using data science techniques, which are also not commonly heard about in podcasts. So I didn't say I'm going to go buy something that's 20 minutes from my house. I didn't say I'm going to go buy something where my father-in-law bought something and made money. I said, where does the data point me to? The entire country is my playground. Where does the data point me to? And that's the methodology that I used.
Absolutely. Definitely read up on those houses in, was it Madera, mm-hmm. California? Yep. That was absolute genius, the way you got them under contract and you bought that other one and used that as the kind of the top of the funnel to get yes. to get the applicants in. And do you still own those? Or
I own all of them. I sold a couple just because I needed to close something in it and I needed cash. So that was about 4 years ago. I haven't sold any of them since. And they performed really well. They're also performing really well through the pandemic because Madera has very high job growth rates. And when job growth rates are very high, that's what typically happens. Now, if job growth rates in Madera fell below, let's say, 1.5% for more than a year, I would just sell them all. I would sell them all and invest in a place that has extraordinarily high job growth. So as it is, I feel like within the next 5 years, I'm going to sell all of them because I am now getting to the point where I'm building generational wealth by building my own communities, not using investor money, but just by using my own. So I'm currently building my first community, 66 units in Idaho Falls, that unlikely to have any investors in that at all. It would just be my money.
That is awesome. That's awesome to scale. And so relatively quickly, right? You started 2008 as full-time. Now you're doing
I didn't start 2008 at full-time. I started doing real estate in full-time as a technology investor. My company was sold in 2013. Right. So, it's after that I've basically had the freedom to invest, significant amount of time into this. At this time, I'm very full in real estate. I do have an enormous team. So most syndication companies tend to be between 3 and 10 employees. We have 28 full-time employees. And all of those people are working, a typical, 8 to 6 type of day. And so they allow us to scale very rapid. So it's a huge team. 10 of the employees, 9 of the employees are in the U.S. And the others are full-time employees in the Philippines.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw that. And I'll probably circle back to that, the asset management army later on in the show. Definitely have some questions on that. My last question for this round here is, so you did the development and then you went back to those, I think it was like 10 single family houses, in Northern California, okay. Right? And then, mm-hmm. and then you started slowly getting back up to the larger commercial. Was that for, like just a personal growth comfort zone thing? Was that like limiting beliefs or like what was, why did you go essentially backwards and then back up? You went back up really fast, but,
Well, actually I did it because I'm an idiot. So, and sometimes, the characteristics of idiots is some person who has lots of experience tells you something that's not true and you believe them. A person in 2011 told me I could only get 10 single family loans and I already owned 10 single families. I should have gone and investigated. And, Google is wonderful. It would have taken me 5 minutes to say, how do you get more loans when you have 10 loans? The answer is, you wrap them into a portfolio loan. And by doing that, you can basically get more loans. I didn't do that research. I was dumb. I was stupid. And basically, I realized that once you get to 10, the only way forward is to go into multifamily, which doesn't have any restrictions. You can buy 1 million multifamily units if you can afford them. And so I moved away from single family too early. Instead of dropping out of single family in 2011, as I did, I should have dropped out of single family in 2014 or 2015 because the numbers still made sense. There was nothing wrong with the numbers. I was already convinced of that because I was running the numbers every single month, every single asset. And so I would have bought another 30 or 40 of them, which would have added maybe, 6 million to my network at this point in time. But that didn't happen. That 6 million didn't happen for only one reason. I had the money. I had the money sitting in the bank. I didn't do anything with it because I listened to a smart person who made a stupid statement and I assumed that he knew what he was talking about, right? And so that piece of idiocy cost me about $6 million.
So what would be the lesson learned? Is trust but verify? Is that the...
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I've noticed is that people make statements without qualifiers. They say X is happening. What they should be really saying, X is happening most of the the time, but about 10% of the time, why happens? Or 5% of the time, why happens? But people make statements as if they're a fact. People make statements as if it's impossible to get any other outcome other than the one that they're talking about. And I've learned over time to basically say, okay, you're probably right. I think it's worth 1 minute of my time to check Google to see if you're actually. And I do this all the time. People make these kinds of very strong statements, and I go back and check on Google, and what I find it is that they're usually right. You know, it's not that they're not right, but they're wrong about 10% of the time or 5% of the time. And 10% and 5% are huge, because that's a massive loophole, right? If I told you that there was a 10% loophole in tax law, you'd take advantage of it all the time, right? So now I'm beginning to understand and learn these kinds of loopholes. And so the message really is trust but verify. It doesn't matter how smart they are. They may not understand your scenario, and that you do have other choices in your scenario. So I did that. But I think the biggest gain that came out of the whole, you know, single family thing for me, obviously wealth came out of it. You know, I own 13 single family homes that are probably worth, each of them is worth $200,000 or $300,000 more than when I bought them. So wealth came out of it, right? 12 years of cash flow came out of it. But I think the biggest thing that came out of it was I learned how to apply my data-driven strategies to real estate. I'd always applied them to four different businesses outside of real estate. But when I applied them to real estate, I realized real estate has the highest return for use of technology and automation compared to all of my careers. When I was in healthcare, the application of automation of data science, the return was not as high. When I was in core technology, it was not as high. When I opened a company to do solar, it was not as high. Real estate has the highest return for use of automation, use of virtual assistants, use of data science compared to anything else that I was involved in. And I learned that in those 3 or 4 years. And then I started to say, okay, well, obviously this works. How do I apply it at scale? How do I apply it to a $10 million asset and then to a $50 million asset? Now I'm applying it to $125 million assets, right? It works all the way across. So that was unique in real estate. I haven't seen anything else be so, you know, you being able to move the needle so far by the use of automation, by the use of a virtual army. Those things are fairly unique to real estate. And I learned that. The other thing that I learned was that even though real estate is one of the biggest industries in the US, the number of people truly applying data science to it is extremely small. I'm sure there's people applying it in data science. I'm sure they're doing it better than me. But those people might be in the top 1% of the 1%. Everybody else is not applying data science, even though they could. So I created a system. One day I said to myself, I want to create not a black box, but a white box. You know, what is a black box? You don't see what's inside of it. You just know that it gives you an output, right? And you have to be content with it. There's lots of people that charge you $25,000 a year so that you can put stuff into their black box and get an output, but they never tell you what's inside. I wanted to create a white box of rules that basically significantly improve your real estate returns. And I call that system the Real Focus System. It took me years to design it. And that system has 5 rules. They're all visible to you. Anybody can change the rules. It has an Excel spreadsheet. And now over 50,000 real estate investors are applying it throughout the US. And I get emails from them all the time saying, I use your rule. I bought here in this weird tertiary market that nobody had ever heard of. And I'm making 50% year over year. People have actually made more money than I've ever made applying the system. So that makes me, you know, very happy. And the system is in 2 parts. There's the cities and the neighborhoods. The cities part is completely free and it's available on Udemy.com. That's the most popular Udemy real estate course. We have currently, I think right now I have 8,000 students taking the course. And it's completely free. There's no upsell. There's no go here and buy something. Nothing like that is provided. And then there's a second portion of the course, which is more powerful, which is, okay, so you figure out the best cities in the US. How do you figure out the best neighborhoods in the US? And that is only available to our bootcamp students. So people who come to Multifamily U and take our Multifamily U bootcamp receive the neighborhood piece of the course. So that piece is not public. And then, of course, we provide additional information in the bootcamp as well. So that system took about 3 or 4 years to design. It was designed for single family, but it actually works fairly well with multifamily as well.
So I am definitely one of those 8,000 students. I don't know if Duke has taken Real Focus. I definitely took it earlier this year, and it drove us to find a neighborhood that we exploited, an undervalued area, just like is in the course. And that portfolio or that property is doing outstanding even through COVID. So much appreciated there. I can attest to Real Focus. It is the real deal. All right, Duke, hand it over to you.
Yeah. So speaking of data, so how do you use data currently to drive your investment decisions, like say multifamily and development?
Data tells me, firstly, that while the value-add world has value, that value is diminishing. And it is pushing me away from value-add, which is my core. That's what I like doing. That's my comfort zone. I want to buy old buildings. I want to rehab them. We're selling a building in about 3 months at a 60% annualized return for our investors. But there was a tweak. How do we get from 19%, which was forecasted, to 60%? Well, I built 29 units that were burned down. I built those, and it spiked our NOI by about 50%. So what I'm beginning to find is that moving from value add to development is what the data is pointing me towards. Most people don't do it, and the standard argument is development is risky. So I am building a new multifamily, either for rental or for sale, and I'm building that. My build to cap is 7, so somewhere around 7. What that means is when it's built at that point, you know, I have the amount of money that I had to put in as equity is about 7 cap. And everywhere in the United States, syndicators are buying 40 and 50 year old properties at sub 5 cap. Which one of those two is more risky? That is what I'm not seeing in the marketplace. People not reacting to a change in the marketplace. In 2013, I was a small investor in an early project in my career called Via de Lagos. And this was a building that another syndicator bought, and I learned from him. And we paid $22,000 for that property. And that property was then sold 2 years later at a huge profit. You know, it was sold for, I think, $46,000 a unit. So it was 22 a unit purchase, 46 a unit sale. Lots of, you know, rehab work was done on it. And then that property was then flipped again in the mid-70s. And then now that property is probably worth a little over $100,000 a unit. My question is, has the wealth of this nation changed enough since 2013 for a $22,000 property to be worth $100,000? We all know it's not the case, mm-hmm. right? But people are assuming that not only is this the case, that property is worth $100,000 now, they're actually assuming that in 3 or 4 years, it'll be worth $140 or $150, $160. And one uncomfortable question that people are not addressing is, well, can't I construct a new property at $160,000? So why would I, 5 years from now, buy this property, which by that time is about 45 years old, why would I buy it when I could construct one for $160,000, right? And that's the question that people are not asking. And so I'm finding that the marketplace is again beginning to resemble 2006 in terms of the challenges that it represents. So I'm pivoting, and I'm also, you know, I'm looking at markets that nobody's heard of, like Idaho Falls. I mean, you guys have never heard of Idaho Falls. I'm sure within 2 years, you're going to hear plenty about Idaho Falls when people are going to be talking about, oh, this is a great syndication market. But the data suggests that it is far and away the best market in the United States. Nothing comes close. There's a huge gap between Idaho Falls and number two market in the U.S. in my mind. And I'm going there and I'm building there because it doesn't actually even make sense to go and buy there at this point in time. And I can just go out and build something. I'm building townhomes, 3-bed, 2.5 baths. And my all-in cost is about $132,000 a unit, brand new, right? These are 1,400 square feet. I can sell them. I can rent them. I can refinance them. I can put a 30-year hard loan at 2% on them. All those options are open.
That is awesome. So Idaho Falls, good thing we have like a 2-month lead until this show airs. We can get in there. I'm joking. So one of the questions I have, and I see a lot of newer people struggle with this, even more successful people that are maybe successful in business and they're trying to understand the data. And this might come second nature to you because you've been doing it so long. But how do you get to the so what when you're looking at just massive amounts of data? Like, how do you extrapolate? How do you synthesize? How do you interpret and just get to the story? Like, what is this, you know, 3,000, city data field with all these data and all these metrics telling me, and how am I going to make a decision of it? What does that thought process go to? I see a lot of people, they get really proficient or efficient and proficient at filling out spreadsheets, right? And putting the numbers in, and it's going to pump out, you know, here's my KPIs, my equity multiple, my whatever. And then that's good. They don't think into it. Or when they're looking at a data, like, okay, job growth is a 3. Okay, check. Your population growth is X, check. And they're just going down a checklist, but they're not really understanding the data, like what the story is of this town or this city. So how do you get from just checking a box and filling in the spreadsheet or whatever with the data to actually making a decision and interpreting it and looking into the future of, you know, making decisions based off of that data?
That's easy. You get on a plane. The purpose of data is to, you know, it that instead of 3,000 plane flights to 3,000 cities, you're flying out to 4 or 5, right? Because until you actually go, I've been going, flying to Idaho Falls during COVID. So imagine the risk. And because it is a deep red state, some of the people that were there refused to wear masks. So I had to cancel meetings because I don't want to be in a room with four people not wearing masks. Even if I was wearing a mask, that would protect them. But so it was very risky, but I would not go and spend millions of dollars of my own money on Idaho Falls until I understood Idaho Falls. So the process is really simple, Vincent. Don't overthink it, right? The metrics that I provide in the Real Focus system leads you to good cities. Now, every good city has its own circumstance. And so very often, I would say 10% of the time, those metrics are wrong. They don't mean anything. They're misleading you because that's the nature of metrics. So to simply say, well, this city is the best in the U.S. because it comes up the best on Neil Bauer's Real Focus system is nonsensical because Neil Bauer never does that. What Neil does is he uses his system to rank cities and then go to those cities and see which one matches the needs of his investors at this point of time. And I can tell you, Idaho Falls doesn't match the needs of multifamily investors. It phenomenally, ridiculously matches the needs of single family investors, right? So the answer is the purpose of data is to give you a short list of 5 or 10 places that you can visit. But beyond that, it is the story of the people there that you talk with that really leads you to the next direction. I do 2-day visits to cities, and I've never done one with less than 12 meetings. So you need to challenge yourself to have 12 meetings when you go to a city. That's hard, but my team sets it up for me when we start the work on going to a city 6 weeks in advance. And we have lots of phone calls that help us learn more and refer us to other people. And we use those phone calls and we use those referrals to build our list of people that we're, sitting down with. And my visits to, like, for example, Idaho Falls, I took a 6 a.m. flight. I got to Salt Lake City at 9. I started my drive to Idaho Falls 3 hours. I got there at noon. I had a noon appointment. And then my appointments continued until 9 p.m., which included dinner. And then the next day, I had appointments that started at 7 at my hotel. And then about 3 o'clock, I started my drive back to Salt Lake City. And I had a 7:30 flight that took me home back at about 9 or 10. That's how much I compress it. And I had my 12 meetings, right? And because I have virtual assistants, if a meeting cancels, my staff just replace people. So they've got a first, second, third alternate in there. So they just let me know, hey, your 4 o'clock has now been replaced by this person. I think that you have to be that structure. The more structured you are, the higher your result. I'm not saying that you won't get result if you, show up without those 12 meetings. You will. Absolutely, you will. But I think you'll get a higher result if you structure it. And don't overthink it. Use the metrics, then visit the metro. That instinct of which metro is better only gets developed through physical visits. The data just shortlists everything for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will attest to the definitely be structured when you go visit. We go to El Paso every once in a while. And every time we kind of sit down and like, okay, here's the people we're going to meet. And then once we get on the ground, you know how it is. Like you get started and it's like you plan on meeting. I've never hit 12. I do like 3 or 4 and I'm like exhausted. Secret shop a couple properties, talk to, lunch with the broker, lunch with the banker. And I'm beat. So kudos to you for doing 12. It might not sound like a lot to people listening, but I'm telling you, I do 4 and I'm like, I'm ready for a nap. So that is awesome. But so one of the things I started doing to get people to understand like the numbers of what the story trying to tell them is I have them do like their neighborhood first or where they grew up. That way when they're like whatever town you grew up with, like do analyze that one first with like a Real Focus or one of those spreadsheets where you're looking at job growth and population growth. That way you understand like, okay, this is what population growth looks like over 20 years. Like I lived in this town my entire life. You can conceptualize what that looks like. And that helps a little bit when you're looking at a new market and it might be similar or more or less than the town you grew up with, but you have like a baseline. So that's why I kind of helping people look at markets and doing the data, like just do the town you grew up with first. That way you can understand some of the data points and what they're trying
to
tell you.
Exactly. And I keep in mind that, we tend to sometimes overly focus on the cities that we're going to. Understand that buying the properties, finding the cities is just the beginning. Your systems and processes need to benefit your investors for the life of the project. When you're asset managing the building, when you're increasing occupancy, increasing rents, lowering expenses, all of this is good for investor returns. And all of this happens through the use of data science. And the reason we have 500 investors is they trust our discipline. They trust our dedication to applying it to all parts of the life cycle, not just to the purchase. So sometimes there's too much of a fixation on it. And the other thing is that if you have something that you you come up with, then share it. Well, I mean, I see so many people listening to podcasts, but I think that you will be a better syndicator, a better investor if you're sharing it. I mean, we are sharing incredible amounts of valuable content. It's completely free at multifamilyu.com. We've got, you know, stuff that is going to save you days of research, deal analysis, opportunity zone, syndication law, getting a loan on your first multifamily. I mean, dozens of webinars like this, and we don't allow any kind of pitching. And that is something that everyone needs to do because it's a community. It's not just about you taking because podcasts are available. It's about you giving.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We definitely try to model our business after that philosophy of giving first. So yeah, you mentioned earlier about the preference towards development because compression of cap rates and that kind of thing. So what other trends and opportunities are you seeing in the multifamily space?
So multifamily is changing because of the rapid compression in cap rates. The compression in cap rates since 2011, 2012 has been stunning, right? If you look at where U.S. cap rates were in 2012 and where they are in 2020, it's stunning. As you know, things have gotten better than most people thought, including myself, through the pandemic. We haven't seen much of a increase in cap rates. We've seen, you know, small increases in price here on this asset. And okay, this one sold for 10% less and that one sold for 5% less. But generally, when you look at the market, there hasn't been much of a change in cap rates so far. I think we're going to see a little bit of that going forward, but you know, vaccines are here, so they bailed us out. So to me, when I'm looking at changes in the marketplace, I don't think that multifamily changes much. You know, the value add world doesn't change much. We think that these lower interest rates have given us another boost so you can, you know, make a value add business work for the next 2 or 3 years. But I think that this cycle ends because when I'm looking at what profits that investors have made over the last 3 years, 80-90% of it was cap rate compression. That concerns me because how can such a model be sustainable? If 80 to 90% of the money that investors are making is because of cap compression, which, you know, I don't create cap compression. Duke doesn't do it. Winston doesn't do it. The market does it. If the market stops doing cap compression, then you've lost 80% of your profits. Well, so it is not a sustainable business. So what I am seeing is I'm seeing syndicators start to pivot. They're making changes because they're realizing that their business model is not sustainable. They got another 2 years out of it because of COVID. But what happens in 2022 or 2023 when, you know, cap compression stops or reverses? Then what do you do, right? So people are looking at new business models. One thing that's interesting to me is I've been doing development projects for about 5 or 6 years. And this year, I'm seeing in syndicators that I give passive money to. You know, I have my favorite syndicators. I think I have 16, you know, passive investments right now. So I give money to other people because, you know, what do you do with the money that you make? You have to put it somewhere. And you can't constantly be putting all of it into your projects because it becomes, you know, all eggs in one basket. So I invest in syndications, hotels, legal syndications, you know, where you're giving money to lawyers to go, you know, fight, you know, class action lawsuits, all sorts of stuff. And one of the things that I've started seeing is in this year, more and more of my favorite syndicators are pivoting. Guess what they're pivoting to? They're doing new construction. They're doing new construction, which when you think about it, makes all the sense in the world. These are people that have done $1 billion of value add without ever doing one new construction project. And now they're doing a $50 million new construction project. So people see the writing on the wall. That's the trend that we're seeing in the marketplace. We're seeing new business classes emerge. One called build to rent is absolutely phenomenal and more people should look at it. I think people don't understand, you know, if I was able to get into a new asset class in its first 2 years, I would be made for life. Well, you have a new asset class. It's 2 years old. It's called build to rent. Look into it, right? And it's very deeply tied to multifamily because it is multifamily that is designed to rent, but they're single family homes or townhomes as opposed to apartments. I think apartments will do fine with new construction, but I think that going forward, COVID has you know, changed the balance. People want more room. They want backyards. They want townhomes that have backyards in them. And so that kind of asset simply doesn't exist in the U.S. and more people are going to build it. And when we do boot camps, we're actually pivoting our boot camps to include some of this content in there. You know, so no one in the U.S. has ever taught a boot camp that's new construction. And we're now beginning to pivot and add content into for new construction into our boot camps because we're like, that's where the opportunity is, right? And our investors understand that. We raise $8 million a quarter in new development projects for investors. $8 million a quarter, $32 million a year. Why? Because the investors get it. Doesn't matter what the syndication industry thinks. We don't have the money. Investors have the money. When they change their mindset, people change with that as well. So we're very laser focused on looking at understanding forward-looking trends. I just don't think that people do that because people are afraid to say that. Like, imagine this. I mean, I have $125 million of value-add real estate, and here I am in a podcast bashing value. People are uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So on your deals, why do you prefer 506C over 506B?
Everyone should only do 506C. I think 506B deals are done by people who are afraid that they will not be able to fill them. If you do the math, you will find that 506C deals will fill up faster than 506B. The only time you should do a B deal is your first deal, your second, and maybe your second. But the third deal, if you're doing a 506B, you're taking a gun, shooting yourself in the foot, and then continuing to shoot other parts of your body.
Well, as we're doing our second and third 506B deal right now. Thanks, Neil. Let's go get that. Yeah. But no, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, me and Duke talk a lot about this, you know, we during our level 10 meetings of, you know, the limiting beliefs of, you know, are we there yet in our experience and our ability to make the jump to 506C and do, you know, bigger deals. But I think we're there. So thanks. That's all needed.
The jump to 506C in itself is a fundamental milestone for your company. Mm-hmm. And when you make that jump grows your business. So we absolutely refuse to have anything to do with 506B.
Got it. Well, I think we're there, Duke. Let's do it. Circling back real quick. So the books, I recently read The Big Shifts Ahead, and I don't know if you read that or not, but it talks a lot about, it's a lot of data stuff, like what you do. But they were just, like I said, synthesizing, kind of extrapolating what they see in the future. And I've seen it a little bit where they're talking about the different demographics of what they're looking for in multifamily. So I think we're seeing a lot of like syndicators, like not just pivot to new development, but pivot to new development with like a niche attached to it, like a new development, senior housing, like redefining what senior housing is, like those type of new developments, or redefining what young professional housing is, like with the lofts and the amenities and, you know, the bigger yards that they're not used to, you know, that what do they call it, Duke? Is it Serban living? Is
Serban, that yes. Yep. That's the word that me and a few other people have coined, Serban.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it makes sense to pivot or to add these kinds of elements, but you have to be careful about it. For example, I have been asked for the last 4 years why I don't do co-living, right? Why don't you have a co-living asset, Neil? You know, it seems like your sort of thing. You're very, you know, advanced. You're kind of cutting edge. People would, you know, have heard about co-living. And the answer is everything has to be looked at in terms of research. When I researched, what I found was there was no evidence that co-living as a financial model was succeeding, right? The number of people that wanted to do it was such a niche that I didn't want to be in like a tiny, tiny niche. I mean, for example, build to rent is a phenomenal model. It's already succeeding. It's already, you know, sub 4 cap. So I think, yes, have something that differentiates you, but make sure it actually is something that works, something that is beneficial, because otherwise it's just marketing nonsense.
Absolutely. And then another one of the points that me and you kind of check ourselves with is like getting this shiny object syndrome, right? It's like, we're trying to build the business around this system or this concept that we've already, you know, done either value add or whatever. And then somebody can talk, you know, let's pivot toward this new like senior living and stuff like that. Like, should we pivot or should we, you know, stay focused and not get the shiny object syndrome? But I guess the data would tell us that would answer our question, right?
Yeah, do the research on these sorts of things.
Absolutely. So for COVID, you know, we closed our first syndication in April. So right around when everything was hitting the fan. And one of the things that you did was those COVID panels, right? It was like panel one, panel two, panel three. So that right then when that happened, we ended up kind of pulling out of a deal or like putting it on ice for a couple of days. So we try to like figure out like what's going on. This was the 11th hour, you know, we're supposed to close in 2 weeks. And like Texas got shut down. So that's when your panels came out and gave us, you know, a little bit of a pricing, not pricing guidance, underwriting assumptions, right? So 30% negative rent growth, things like that. No new income. So we ended up using that. So thank you for doing those panels. They're truly valuable, and us trying to understand and model while we're underwriting on a deal, while we're supposed to be closing a deal, and going back and completely trashing our original pro forma and rebuilding it toward a lot of what you were saying, a lot of a few other people, what they were projecting. We ended up closing that deal. So awesome. Thank you. And it's operating phenomenally, like a lot of people, especially in Texas. And that was back in April. And I think you did one in May. I think you did one in June too. So since then, how has your opinion changed on COVID, or is it just kind of, is it more or what you're projecting now?
I think that I was the real scenario was not as bad as I thought, as other people thought, because we forgot that you don't fight the Fed, right? One thing I've learned over and over again, and this is a lesson that I seem to forget every time I learn it, is that the U.S. Federal Reserve is the most important agency in the world, not just the U.S., but in the world. You know, I often say, that the president of the Fed is the real president of the United States, right? So, or the chairman of the Fed, because they have the control that they have over the economy, the level of skill that they have, you know, because it's a truly data-driven organization. I mean, I admire the Fed in terms of how data-driven they are. I think the changes that the Fed made, the interest rate cuts, the aggressiveness with which they did it in mid-March in the first month of the pandemic was truly phenomenal. And so the impact that they had on the economy was outsized, was humongous. So even right now where you have huge numbers of people laid off, you have the stock market doing well. Why is it doing well? Because of the changes that the Fed made. Because obviously any benefit that we might have seen from the stimulus is long gone. You know, that effect was gone by September. We're in December now. So obviously why, if the economy continues to do well, it's because of what the Fed is doing. So the Fed's action was absolutely phenomenal, had enormous impact on the marketplace and prevented there being crashes in the marketplace. You know, we've still seen some decline in multifamily pricing, but not of the sort that me and others, you know, we thought of. So as far as I'm concerned, I believe that my COVID forecasts were simply bearish. It was the people that were bullish that were right. It wasn't.
I will say, though, that because of your bearish, we redid our underwriting, realized that we had, what was it, like an $80,000 or $90,000 deficit. We were able to use that and go back and get a seller credit 11th hour at closing. The seller conceded and we got a $90,000 credit at closing. That was our delta that we needed for our working capital to make sure we had enough liquidity to weather the coming storm.
Now that I know this, I will make sure I'm wrong with all of my future predictions.
Well, it worked out for us, so much appreciate it. And I said that deal is operating phenomenally. Our investors are very happy. We were able to, you know, stay afloat. We were not concerned liquidity wise that we were not going to be able to pay our investors or pay the bills. So much appreciated on that. So completely switching gears again for my last question is I want to get back to that asset management army. So this is something that's really unique. And I think when you were talking about there's not a whole lot of syndicators out there that are exploiting technology to the level that you are. Like some of them do some bits of automation here. And, you know, Yardi can do a lot of it. AppFolio can do a lot of things like the texting and whatnot. But you're on a whole different like level. You're in a different league of your automation army or your asset management army. So would you be able to give us like the high level view of this thing you built, this team you built overseas, and then you bolted onto your property managers, and it's just the efficiencies that you get from it, and where does that show in your KPIs?
So this is, by the way, something that we teach in detail in our bootcamp. So it's step by step instructions on hiring virtual assistants and basically plugging them into your property. So here's the truth: I have never found a property manager in the U.S. that shared the same exact motivation as us, right? When we are renting out a covered parking spot for $30 a month, here's what owners think. Here's what Vincent and Duke think, right? You guys are thinking, okay, it's a $30 parking spot. That's $360 in a year. Over 5 years, it's going to be $1,800. And then that $360 a year, when I sell it at cap six, I'm going to get 16 times that much. So I'm going to add in the 5 years, which is the $1,800. And I'm going to add in all that cap money. And now basically that parking spot is worth, I don't know, you know, $7,000 or $8,000, because I'm counting the price at exit. I'm counting the $30 a month for 5 years. That's what you think, right? That's what I'm thinking. Guess what the property manager's thinking? He's thinking $30 a month, 3% of that is what I'm earning. So this parking spot is worth 90 cents. So you can never, ever compel a property manager anywhere in the United States to go out and make phone calls to get that one parking spot ever. If it's happening, it's happening because people want them. It's not happening because your property manager is pushing it. So bottom line is, you can never find a property manager whose motivations exactly match yours, because you're an owner and they're simply getting 3% of whatever the rent is. They don't think the future, because there's never any future for them. They don't benefit from the cap compression. They don't benefit from the multiplier effect. So what we found was there was no great property managers in the U.S. because of this. There's never any alignment. And then there are a bunch of people who try and do property management themselves. But the downside of that is you're missing out on all the great things about what these third-party property management, their reach in the marketplace, their knowledge of the marketplace. You miss on all of that stuff out, because how can you be experts in six different markets? You can't. You don't live in six different markets, right? So, you know, what I found was the king solution was a third-party property manager. And an even longer solution was managing it yourself. So I was like, I need to find a third solution. People are like, how is that even possible? So I invented a solution. I built a team in the Philippines called the Efficiency Center. So the full-time team, lots of employees, managers, supervisors. And these people, they sit on top of a third-party property manager. They sit on top. So it's not a separate, I don't manage the property. The property manager manages the property. This team sits on on top of it. And what this team does is it optimizes everything that we know property managers suck at. Getting reviews from tenants for Google, the managers suck at that. Delinquency phone calls, the managers suck at. Full phone calls 90, 60, 30 days before a renewal comes up. Property managers suck at that. You know what they don't suck at? Showing the property, because they do it every day. But you know what they suck at? Calling people back and filling out on the web. So we took over that stuff. You know, we're going to generate 10,000 leads ourselves for tenants. We're going to process those leads. We're going to put them in AppFolio. And then if those people don't show up, we're going to call them back. Those kinds of things. Basically, be a force multiplier. Try not to take on the property manager's job, figure out what they're weak at, and take those tasks away. And so we built these teams up, and they've had incredible impact. For example, a property called Park Canyon, it's one that we're selling in a few months. And we were able to, with our efforts and our team, have that property go through the entire pandemic with a total of $1,500 in delinquency, which we subsequently recovered. This is a 180-unit property. It's not in a great market. It's not some fancy, you know, class A property. It's, you know, 30-plus-year-old property in a tertiary market that you've never even heard of. So by optimizing everything, every aspect of what we do, generation of leads, processing of leads, you know, processing of apps, there's so many things that property managers really suck at. The only reason they can do it is every other property manager sucks at it. So if you fire them and go to somebody else, you still have the same problem. So I solved it by building a secondary team. And that has had an enormous impact. We sold a property. It was our toughest property. It was a problem property, had lots of delinquency, had lots of bad tenants. We were able to sell that at a 22% annualized return because what we did was we filled that property. We generated over 10,000 tenant leads for this property. And through those tenant leads, we generated over $400,000 in additional NOI for this property. And when we did that, we were able to exit, even though it was a horrible property, to be honest. That's key. That's how you use technology. That's how you use, virtual assistant. And we've taken that and we've rolled it out across our company, and we display how we do it in different parts of our company.
That's incredible. And we just had a call like an hour ago with our property manager, and we took over a property and we're trying to figure out how to change the Google name from the old people to the new people. And then like all the reviews are wrong and not there. So we're like, we got to figure this out. So very timely that we just spoke about that. So definitely going to be checking that out.
For our fire round, what is the best book that you recommend other than Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
It's not the best book. I think it's the most effective book. It is The Miracle Morning. Because while there are many books that are better than The Miracle Morning, The Miracle Morning gives you the time to read the rest. That's why it's the most effective book of all.
Makes sense. So what is your superpower?
My superpower is that I'm mildly autistic. If you remember Matrix and you remember Neo, he could read the Matrix, those green drops, right? I can read numbers just like that. When I see numbers, all sorts of weird patterns appear to me. I have never figured out why they appear, but they appear all the time.
What is the biggest lesson that you've learned over your career?
Don't just focus on your partners being ethical. They need to be both ethical and competent. I used to think that the most important kind of partner is one that was ethical and an honest person. I've realized that you actually need competency and ethics both.
That makes sense. So for the busy working professional who's working towards financial freedom, what advice do you have?
Get less busy. Right now, there are two people reading my email and sorting it into, you know, sub boxes. Everyone that I know of reads their email by clicking on their inbox. I don't do that. I click on 1-high. That's the only folder I live in. That's an example. Obviously, I have more money. I have more resources. Point is, everyone starts the same way. I started just the same way as you. If you're a busy professional, your first job should not be to go out and buy property. It should be to find ways to get less busy. I challenge you. You can do it. Everyone can do it.
Make a surplus, right? Make a surplus of your time. Find surplus.
Surplus of your time. That start there. Surplus of your time. I mean, if you need to read one book about that, it is Timothy Ferris's The 4-Hour Work Week.
Big fan of Tim Ferriss. So you've been so generous with your time. How can our audience get in touch with you?
Well, two different ways. I've done over 100 podcasts, some where I talk about asset management, some where I talk about the Real Focus system, some where I talk about my virtual army. You can find those 100 podcasts by simply Googling my name followed by the word podcast. And if you want specific podcasts, you can say Neil Bawa Asset Management Podcast or Neil Bawa Virtual Army Podcast, and you'll see them. That's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me. There's about 100 of those podcasts out there and conferences. And then if you want structured content from us, which is offered for free, you have to go to multifamilyu.com, which has the newest version of our Real Focus course. It's the most comprehensive and new version of our course with the new trackers that we built in 2020. So multifamilyu.com will give you access to about 20 or 30 of our projects. If you are interested in investing with us, like the 500 investors that we're giving $4 million in cash flow to, all you have to do is to go to our business website, which is growcapitus.com. That's GROCAPITUS.com. Hopefully you can include that in the show notes because it doesn't have an easy to type in name. Capitus.com, and you'll see our 18 projects. We have 6 projects coming up in the next 6 months. 4 are new development and 2 are value add. So we'd love to talk with you about those.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. And we'll put in for the show notes, we'll put in the Udemy course for the real focus. I'll put the most famous U, and that's the letter U, not Y-O-U.
That's right. Yep. The Udemy course is not updated any longer. Okay. So it's the multifamily U version. It's the same course.
Okay.
But the multifamily U one comes with the new track.
Like, perfect. So we'll scratch Udemy, multifamily U, and then the Grow Capitus will be in the show notes. So thank you again for your time and lots of wisdom. I got three pages of notes just from the last hour. So, and we're going to have to go debrief after this.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for having me on the show, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, man, Duke, I told you Neil Bala was not going to disappoint. So much content. I'm like I said, on the show, I got 3 pages of notes here. I'm going to have to go over, kind of digest, organize. I got some actionable tips out of it. You know, some of the biggest things I got out of this was, you know, his comment on automation delivering some of the highest ROIs that you can get when applied to real estate versus other business activities in general, not just real estate. And we can attest to that in our own business on just the small scale we're doing, something as simple as having an automated text message sent to residents that have a delinquency has reduced our delinquency substantially to an act like a, and we track that KPI, we track that metric. So just that one thing that we do, been phenomenal. So I can imagine like actually, developing what he, you know, his asset management army, which he called the efficiency center, and developing that and then giving that, having that supplement our property managers that we have in our portfolio and just really turbocharging their results. And so we're going to be absolutely implementing, those things when it comes to especially lead generation, appointment scheduling. Those are easy ones. Another one I took away was the soliciting for feedback or for reviews on things like apartments.com, on Google, on Trulia, on Zillow, and all those other sites, and having a mechanism where we don't have to think about it. The property manager, it's not on their plate, but somebody's going out and soliciting reviews because that stuff really does matter. It's one of those things that like nobody likes doing, but it really does matter to the success of your business. And a lot of times it's, you know, how do you calculate an ROI of paying somebody to do a 5-star review on your property? It's kind of hard, but to Neil's point, he's actually crushing the competition, so to speak, because of this. So we are going to be absolutely implementing those. His build to rent concept, that's definitely something I earmarked here for further investigation. I think this is what one of our property managers is doing in one of our markets. So I'm going to call him and see if this is the model that he is doing, but also another fascinating model. And the point of that was to his point of value add business model might be coming to the end of its cycle just because there's been so much cap rate compression that investors really need to, and syndicators really need to scrutinize the investments. Like, is this really a value add, or am I just buying something and it looks good because the market keeps going up and the cap rates keep compression? So that is something that we look at, and that's why we target, you know, those off market mom and pop deals. We don't really buy from other investors too often because then you end up just buying their flip, essentially, is what happens. They buy it, they hold it for 1 year, 18 months, 2 years, and then they do some work and then appreciation hits it and cap rates go down. So that adds some appreciation and you're just buying their flip with, you know, some meat on the bone. So I don't really like looking for those. We steer away from those. We go more, try to go more direct to seller, those mom and pop owners that have owned it for 20, 30, 40 years. And that's kind of how we're still finding value. But I see absolutely to his point of the value add model might be at the end of its cycle this time around. So you might want to start looking at ways to pivot to keep your business growing, right? I also like his comment on the jump to 506C, you know, and we've talked about this before. And I think, you know, after him talking about it, again, this is definitely, I think, a limiting belief that we have in our company. And I had, you know, no problem saying that of, you know, 506C is comfortable, right? It's comfortable. It's manageable. We understand it. 506C definitely seems like a big leap, but, you know, he said, you got to make the leap. It'll be a substantial milestone, he said.
to your business's growth and probably credibility as well. If you complete, 506C transaction and have that on your resume and under your belt, just like anybody doing their first agency loan or something like that, or their first syndication, like these are important milestones, right? So I think we are right there and it's time for us to make that jump. So probably by the time this airs, we'll be advertising for our 506C. And that is, the last one, huge point here. And I do this with a lot of my students as well. We do a lot of data crunching. We have all of our sheets of here's what you look for: population growth, job growth, crime rates, income growth, and all these things. And then it's like, okay, I filled out the sheet. So what? What does this mean? I have a hard time, especially when you're looking at a new market, like conceptualizing what this market looks like. Like, what does a 3% population growth year over year look like? What does a 2% job growth look like? What is the decreasing, crime rate over the last 5 years at whatever 50 points look like? And a lot of people are like, okay, I fill out a sheet. What does that mean? What decisions can I make based off of this? What is this data telling me? What's the so what of this data? I think his point was very simple. And because it's so simple, it's often overlooked. People are like trying to find these sophisticated models of what to do with this data and how to make decision points based off this data. His point was just go visit the market, right? Just get on a plane, go spend a couple of days there and walk around and see and meet people that are players in the market. And you'll see you can look around and look at the growth of, an area, the new buildings going up, the pads getting, the concrete pads getting poured for new construction, things like that. Or conversely, shopping centers closed down and strip malls, missing half their tenants, and things like that, and homelessness around the cities and stuff like that, in places that you wouldn't really expect, right? You can see that and like, okay, this is what, a crime rate of 400 looks like. This is what a crime rate of 200 looks like, right? I think that was very, very simple and very eloquently stated of just get on a plane and go visit the market, spend a couple of days there. Don't overthink that. Just the data is just one tool, and don't read too much into it. Don't read a story that isn't there. And that is mainly what I talk about. Big plug also to his Real Focus. I took that a few years ago, and it has definitely helped us at the time, definitely helped us define what markets we're going into and then why we were going into the market. We can do the Real Focus. Like I said, it was like 3-hour online class, very easy, but it definitely gave you some good solid pointers that we still use today of how to evaluate a market and then why we're going into that market, and then further avenues to dive down to that rabbit hole if we want to. So that is all I got. I'm super grateful for Neil's time, and I loved this episode.
And if you're interested in connecting with us, go to tricityequity.com to learn more and download our free guide to passive investing in multifamily. To connect with like-minded investors, join our Facebook group, Honolulu Multifamily, and more. If you found value in this podcast, please subscribe and give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you know anyone who might resonate with today's podcast, please share the episode with them. See you next time.